Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Jazza, who are you supporting in the Euro Football Championship this year?
Oh, Jimmy, that is a very good question. As somebody who is of an incredibly mixed heritage of both England, Scotland, and Ireland, both. I don't. Never mind. I'm very, very English. Like, I am several generations away from when my family were based in Edinburgh.
I mean, that doesn't stop a lot of Scots, to be honest with you.
No, that doesn't stop. Generally, growing up, we supported Scotland in the rugby and England in everything else. I think only because we were glory hunters. And it's only now that I am older and more cynical that I have recognised that behaviour in myself and the members of my family.
Scotland are not very good at rugby these days.
They were in like the 90s, I think.
Okay.
Or they were at least better than England. And then England had like a really great run in the naughty, won the World Cup, obviously. Yeah. And then I think for a short time we were also England rugby fans. Basically, I'm a shill and should not be trusted in my authenticity of support for any team whatsoever. But I will be supporting England, although I did forget that the Euros were a thing until yesterday.
Good job. You said you'd be supporting England. There's an interesting phenomenon I've noticed among English progressives with sometimes tenuous claims to other national allegiances.
Hello. Hello, soy yo, estoy aquí.
I don't know. What are you talking about?
Sorry, never mind. I was saying hello in Spanish. Go on.
Seriously. But I'm talking about sort of people who maybe have one English and one Scottish parent and who the large majority of their lives in England, and yet out of a perverse dislike of English culture, choose to support solely Scotland.
To be fair, more of a claim than anyone in my family has ever had.
I mean, you're...
My great-granddad was Scottish.
Yeah, I think
so. You
that's
see
legit.
How much I'm stretching it.
I suppose, you know, people have to draw lines where they draw lines, don't they? We're of course bringing up the Euros, Jazza, because our first topic this week is...
When did we become a football podcast? First of all, the Super League, and now this. My God, lads!
Providing some of the lowest quality football commentary on the internet. At the Right Dishonourable podcast. But we are going to be discussing Gareth Southgate, who is the England manager and has penned
he's a sexy man as well.
Is like, he?
He was awkward. He looked awkward in his 20s and 30s. It has now really grown into his slightly lopsided face.
I see. Well, you know, hope for us all, I think. Gareth Southgate, with a slightly lopsided and bearded face these days, has written a letter for the Players' Tribune, where he's kind of laid out his vision for, you know, for a kind of new patriotism in England, or maybe that's putting it a lot too grandly, but there's a lot. That's how it's been interpreted by the commentariat, I think it's fair to say. He's basically said he's sort of trying to marry some of the old traditions of English patriotism. So there's a reference to like Queen and Country, and there's some stuff about the military because his grandfather was a Royal Marine. And then he's also saying, I know that the younger generation see things differently, and, you know, that's fine. And he's trying to bridge gaps between different visions of Englishness. Mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say, and this is in the context of much debate around the England players kneeling before football games, as they are still planning to do.
And lots of booing happening.
In
some cases, lots of booing happening.
Yeah. Well, this has happened at a couple of Premiership games and
a couple of our warm-up matches. I can't remember who it was against, but had particularly vocal booers.
Yeah. So as Jazza said, in our tradition, pivoting towards football podcasting, we're going to be discussing that as our first topic on this here podcast. We've actually got a second sports related topic.
The Right Dishonourable Soccer football and cricket podcast is called TRD
know.
Balls.
Yeah,
that's our sports spin-off.
Yeah, if we ever decide to do a sports podcast, which probably won't happen. But this story is about Ollie Robinson, who is a cricketer. Jazza, are you a big fan of cricket?
I hate it with every fibre of my being.
I think that's a no. So Ollie Robinson has who's an England bowler, is due to miss two games with Sussex, which is his
county team.
Do they have premierships in cricket? This is,
I don't really know, but you play for generally teams are counties.
Yes, that is true. Yeah, that is true.
National players play for counties.
But he's due to miss two games because some tweets were unearthed when he was a young man. He's now 27. When he was a younger man, I suppose you could say. When he made some off-colour tweets, should we say. There were some derogatory comments about women. He also apparently made references to the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, the suicide of footballer Gary Speed, and also comments about women, Asian people, and people with disabilities. I'm reading this from iNews. There's been a bit of, I mean, this has sort of been an emerging trend of people who grew up on social media and now have public roles of some sort. And then, you know, people go back and look through their posts and the results are not always positive, as you might expect. Mm-hmm. Boris Johnson and other members of the government have said that, you know, Robinson has apologised. And they feel that, like, people should move on and that he shouldn't be punished for things he said a decade ago or roundabouts. Mm-hmm. I guess this is very much in our ballpark, really. This is like a social media free speech story, isn't it, Jazza?
Mm-hmm. Also, lads, sport, ball, ball, ball.
I can see this is going to be a great episode.
Yeah, I'm gonna take everything incredibly seriously.
Incredibly seriously.
Talking about taking things seriously.
Yes. Do you want to introduce the third topic, Jazza?
Many a person will be watching the beautiful north coast of Cornwall this week, because all of the world leaders, well, not all of them, but like some of the like classiest ones, like there's some of the sexiest ones, so Emmanuel Macron, Justin Trudeau, not really Joe Biden, but you know what, he's in his day, he was all right, wasn't he? They've all descended on Cornwall to take part in the G7 summit, where they're going to be talking about several things as the seven largest economically democratic nations / blocks, right?
I mean, it's kind of a assemblage of sort of Western Europe and then a few of their buddies, basically.
And Japan.
Yeah, well, Japan's one of the buddies, isn't it? So, as is the US, I suppose.
I think that's quite derogatory. That's quite, like, an offhanded way to talk about, like, the world's third largest economy, Jimmy.
Maybe.
But they're all here to talk about climate change, vaccine, philanthropy, anything else. That's about it, really.
Yeah, that's...
taxing companies, or like in the case of the UK, saying you're going to tax a company or global companies and then saying, oh, but not most of the ones that function and work in the UK.
I see. So, you know, lots of stuff for us to dig our teeth into there, Jazza.
Yes.
Should we tell people about the Patreon, play some music, and get on with the main podcast?
Yes.
If you are a fan of the Right Dishonourable podcast, you can support us by going to patreon.com/rightdishonourable. There you can subscribe to us on an episodic basis, which gives you access to exclusive segments that we do not release to anybody else. Our current patrons include Alexander Wood, Andrew Kilpatrick, David Preston, Gemma Cumming, John O, Matt, and Michael Costa. Thank you very much for supporting the show. Also, if you don't think you're getting enough from me on this podcast, you can read my weekly newsletter on politics and other things at jdenichols.substack.com. Also, you can watch Jazza play Pokemon on his YouTube gaming channel, which for some reason can be found at youtube.com/JazzaInChina. That's probably enough advertising for one episode, so now on with the show. So, Jazza, you very much poo-pooed my description of Gareth Southgate's letter as a description of a new kind of patriotism, or English patriotism specifically. What's your take on it, then?
It's a stretch of my interpretation of it in the intro. Poo-pooed it. I
think you poo-pooed it, man. How would you say you responded to my description?
It's exaggerations like that, Jimmy, that is why people hate journalists.
They still click on the stories, mate, so, you know, say one thing, do another.
I think he is, rather than presenting a new patriotism, because I don't think there is, I don't think he really has an answer to what is the new equivalent of serving your country, queen and country, etc., that resonated with him and his dad, for example.
His granddad, specifically.
His granddad, sorry. I think it is more of a trying to link especially older generations to understanding why younger generations approach their patriotism maybe in a different way to their dads or their uncles or whatever. And I think that it was a very effective kind of like attempt of unity based around sport. And actually, I think it was a great representation of, like, say, for example, go back to the World War II days. Young boys used to have war heroes and kind of like wanted to be army fighter pilots. Mm. Army pilots. Those famous army pilots.
I mean, the US Army has pilots, so I don't think you're entirely wrong.
Yeah, great.
I think they were actually sort of...
But now they've moved and they've gravitated towards... because, I mean, war generally, I think, is broadly a bad thing. And nowadays, in this peaceful world that we now live post-World War II, broadly, everybody has pictures of sports stars. And they are, therefore, representative of the aspirations and the pride that people have towards where they are from. And especially because, I mean, like, the Premier League and the England football team is much more ethnically diverse than England as a whole, as an example. Mm. And so things like social justice and racial justice especially are going to resonate with that group a lot more, and is probably one of the reasons why they have ended up collectively as a team decided to take the knee regularly at the beginning of every game, right?
And
that doesn't resonate with the older generation because they didn't have those those role models who were maybe for whom stuff like racial justice would have resonated as much. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I don't think it's purely a generational thing. Obviously, the taking the knee comes from the Black Lives Matter movement and became particularly sort of globalized in the wake of George Floyd's death. I think we discussed it last week, although it may have been in the bonus segment for the Patreon. I don't think it's purely a generational thing. I think it can also be classified as regional. It's also there's sort of an element of class, I think, as well to it. Like certain areas of the country, I just think that racial justice isn't as salient, you know, either because certain areas of the country are, you know, much whiter than, say, places like London or Birmingham, for instance. And actually, probably the main concerns are, politically speaking, are about improving the lot of poorer white people, I guess you could say. England fans for football come from all sorts of places, so... I think I mentioned in a previous podcast, I heard a story about a school not very far from where I live where the largely black sort of kids who attend there will take a knee before playing football in the playground at lunchtime and so on, which I imagine there's certain areas of the country where that stuff like that just doesn't happen at all because it's just not as, it isn't as relevant to their lives depending on what ethnic background you're from. So this letter that Gareth Southgate has written, as we indicated in the intro, does come after a lot of the debate around taking the knee and also the booing that has taken place at stadiums. You seem to think that the booing is quite a prevalent problem Whereas other commentators have tried to minimise it. I remember that, I think it was at one of the England games, there was one of the friendlies you mentioned, there was booing that took place when the England players took the knee, followed by louder cheers, what were, you know, largely described as louder cheers in the
press.
Yeah,
that is often what happens. Yeah. I think you're misrepresenting me again, Mr. Nicholl.
I'm just saying.
It happens. Occasionally, under particular circumstances, especially the most recent one, the booing was particularly loud, and commentators did mention that. But they have at least in England have been almost always drowned out by cheering. But I think we'd be amiss if we didn't mention the booing, because it's a bit shit.
I suppose it's a substantial minority of people who are booing. It's fair to say it's not just a few, like a few loonies. That's kind of the overly derogatory word. But I think that something that when Southgate has been discussing these issues, I think he's really tried to play down the political nature of the gesture of taking the knee. And I think that, you know, I personally wouldn't boo somebody taking the knee, but I also wouldn't take the knee myself. And I think it is a very political gesture. And I think
that's not what you said when we took the knee before we recorded this podcast.
These spurious allegations, utterly unsubstantiated. But I think he should be more honest and say, yeah, it is a political thing. It's something that the team has decided, the actual players, rather than, you know, being an order that has come down from on high, although clearly there's no objections from, you know, the I suppose it would be the Football Association who can organise the England football team.
Who sometimes, to be clear, do stop those kinds of things, like the ability to, they decided players can't wear the poppy, for example.
I don't think that was the FA. I think that was UEFA, actually.
Was that UEFA?
I think it was one of the international organisers. And you're right. I was just going to mention that, because I think there was an England football kit with a poppy design sort of sewn onto it. Mm. And I think they were told they'd be fined or something if they wore it. And I think they did wear it anyway. So it's, and you know, I would still, I mean, the poppy is also, is subject to its own controversies, but I think the poppy has been politicised. I think, you know, it was originally just a commemorative thing for war dead during World War One, but I don't think you can deny that it has political connotations and that some people object to it. So, I mean, an interesting counterpoint, I think, that I haven't really seen being brought up, but that's very much like a more sacred symbol for right-wing people compared to the kneeling, which is more resonant with left-wing
kind of like
people.
The other side of the coin, right? Yeah. I can't remember. We definitely covered. I think we covered the poppy thing in some way, shape, or form back when it was particularly salient, at least we talked about it. I can't remember, and I can't really remember what I thought about it. And so I may be a hypocrite and be changing my view on this whole thing.
How dare you change your view?
Because now I know. Who am I, Theresa May? My views have evolved. But I think this now because, quote unquote, my lefty liberal side are the ones who are choosing to do something political with sport. I am at least consistent in saying that sport pretends that it's not political, and it is intensely, intensely political.
It's political in places. I think it is also just a game at the end of the day.
It is just a game, but in so many ways, like the links that I drew from, like the heroes that young boys, especially, and young girls have, are now sportsmen rather than people who go off to war. It is sport, really, in our zeitgeist, is a replacement for conflict in a lot of ways in our postmodern world. Sorry to get academic, Jimmy. And I think I'm broadly okay with those kinds of tribalisms and channeling of masculinity to go into this rather than, you know, actual violence.
Right. Okay. I don't think anyone's going to disagree on that front. That
good, excellent. It's better. Football better than war. Hot take.
Yeah, I guess so. There's an interest. Yeah, go on.
I have a question. Do you? Does anything that Southgate say resonate to you? Do you feel any British or English, specifically in this case, pride here?
I think that I largely don't care about sports, but there have been moments where I have been swept up in the kind of the narrative, to use an academic term, Jazza, around a particular game. I remember, like, the way we're going to talk about cricket later, and it is going to become readily apparent that I don't really care for it. But when England won the World Cup, which I think was in 2019, if memory serves, I was just around a friend's house.
The Cricket World? Did we win the Cricket World Cup?
Yeah, we did. We did, Jezza. And
great.
I hadn't
wasn't
really...
even aware that there was a Cricket World Cup.
Of course, there's a Cricket World Cup. And I didn't follow England's progress through that tournament. But I did watch the last match.
Because it is the worst and most boring game to
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah. Let's save the bashing for the relevant segment. And I didn't, I very much bought into it. I thought it was like moving in the way that sport can be when there's a kind of epic sweep to it, I guess, and it feels kind of like profound in some way. So I'm not like entirely immune to it, but I just don't really get it in these sort of week-to-week games that like football fans will be familiar with, where every single loss is genuinely like emotionally painful to them in a way. So yeah, in some ways it doesn't. I mean, it doesn't really do it for me. There was an interesting stat though that shows that it obviously a lot of people care very much about football. There's an interesting stat about which think tank is this from? British Future. They commissioned a study into sort of attitudes.
Whose side are they on?
I think they're sort of left wing. Ish.
Cool. I really wish that there were a clear way to know like which party a think tank is aligned to, because they all sound, all of their names sound exactly the same. It makes it very difficult. I've got to Google them.
It's tough when you have to Google people.
Tell me about it.
So a question that was asked in some of the surveys they did for this report: do these symbols of England belong to people of every race and ethnic background in England today? And the England football team is regarded as more unifying. So 66% of white people and 65% of BME people regard it as sort of a unifying symbol that belongs to every race and ethnic background. And if you compare that to the English flag, that's 59% of white people, 48% of BME people. So I think the England football team is in some ways kind of a safer zone for like British national identity than you know.
Well, English national identity.
Yes, exactly. Actually, yeah, that's what I should have said. But and I think there's just there's a kind of stigma around flying the England flag. I mean, there's the Emily Thornberry tweet from several years ago.
Oh, yeah, where I knew that was going to come up.
Where she tweeted an image of a white van. A white van outside of a house, and then there was an England flag being draped from a window or something. And this was widely taken. For some, I don't know how justifiable this was in hindsight, but it was widely taken that the kind of uncommented on image that she posted to social media was...
No, she said the view from wherever it was.
Did she say the view from... Okay.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I think that was the text that accompanied it.
But I don't know if she really was sneering. I think it was just a photo. But
I think it was.
Yeah.
She's from Islington, for goodness sake.
You're besmirching the good people of Islington.
Well, not good people. 100%. Yeah, I think that she was just being a bit of a snob.
Fair enough. But one of the few times...
Can you begrudge somebody just a little bit of British, of English snobbery? I don't know. Like it's...
That's part of our national
identity, isn't it?
I don't. But during football tournaments, you can fly an England flag, and it's kind of regarded as uncontroversial, I think, or it's definitely less controversial.
If you fly a flag during this was the thing. There was an England match that weekend that she was in this constituency, and she was ignorant to that. To be fair, not everybody has to be a football fan. To be fair, I feel like England in sport is the only acceptable time for you to fly a St. George's flag. because outside of those times, it does come across a bit racisty, doesn't it? It's a little bit EDL.
I think that is that's the unfortunate connotation.
Isn't it a shame?
Yeah, is I mean.
To be fair, it's a shit flag.
I disagree. I think it's quite a nice flag, just visually speaking. In pure aesthetic
like
terms.
The union flag, proper pretty, like very good, great design, lovely, stands out.
Yeah, the union jack is a very nice flag. Yeah.
I feel like the St. George's flag, the English flag, is just very boring.
I think it's better than the, just to offend as many people as possible. It's better than like the Irish Republic flag, which is just quite a boring tricolour.
I think tricolours should be banned.
Should be banned. Wow. Yeah. I was not expecting such full-throated support for that sentiment.
And tricolours, yeah. Like, I still can't tell the difference between Luxembourg, Russia, and the Netherlands. They're basically the same flag. Like, yeah. I think the blue is a slightly different blue on each of them or something.
You may well be right. I suppose just to sum up this topic before we get diverted too much into flagland, do you think that that Gareth Southgate will be seen as a kind? I mean, in some quarters, he already is seen as quite a sort of authority figure, a kind of almost like a dad-like figure in some way.
He even refers to himself a bit of a dad figure, doesn't
he?
Yeah,
he does.
Which I think I'm like, all right, I'm like, toot your own trumpet, mate. I think he's lovely. I want him to like run something like the England football team.
Well, I mean, fortunately.
If only.
I mean, I've got to say he's...
England, we should also say England go into these Euros the favourites to win.
Wow. I mean, it'll be even more disappointing when they don't, I think.
Don't spin that with my sails.
I don't know much about football, but I do know that England generally fail.
Fail more than they succeed. That is true.
I think we often have good teams on paper that don't necessarily coalesce. But maybe under Southgate,
Jimmy,
they will.
No, I'm sorry, mate. Just to be very clear, we aren't a football podcast. We don't know what we're talking about. Speaking of not knowing what we're talking about, played any cricket recently?
No, I mean, I definitely prefer cricket to you. Like, I think that...
I think it is... I have a visceral reaction to it. Can I tell you why?
Did you have a bad experience when you were a child?
Because, I have had a cricket ball in the nuts and it does hurt. But also, my dad and my brother are, like, intense cricket fans. And they would insist... We only had one TV when I was growing up. And they would insist on having the cricket on all through the summer. What else am I going to bloody do? Read a book?
Well, you're dyslexic, aren't you? So you can't really
read. Exactly! How selfish. and so, because of that, I have viscerally hated cricket ever since.
I don't really care that much about cricket, but it can be quite a pleasant thing to have on in the background while you're it does take
you're
a lot
you're making me angry.
One of my favorite facts about cricket is one of the reasons it was popularized in India is that the British military liked to play it because it took up so much time
because they had nothing else to do.
Correct. Yeah.
Who knew that colonialization was such a labor short?
Well, it's one of the things they say about war is it's long periods of boredom punctuated by short periods of terror.
Said that?
I can't remember. It's a good quote, though.
Yeah, great quote.
So we're not really talking about cricket as a quality game. We are here to discuss Ollie Robinson, who is an England bowler, and I assume he bowls for Sussex as well.
Did you know or care who he was beforehand?
I've not heard of him before, as far as I'm aware. Probably after we do this segment, I won't hear much about him again. But he's... Was he suspended? Am I right in saying he was suspended over the tweets by the England?
Yeah, suspended over board. Historic racist and sexist tweets.
There you go.
Quote BBC.
So some of the tweets, just to give you a flavour of what they were, and these have been described to me as actually redolent of Sickopedia, which was like a sort of offensive Wikipedia parody. Did you not remember this? I don't know if it's still going.
No, not really.
Yeah, I remember when I was a teenager, some of my friends showed
like Urban Dictionary.
similar, I guess. Yeah, similar levels of offensiveness, I would say. So some of the tweets that have, these are, this is from iNews again, is my Muslim friend is the bomb, hashtag way.
You really conveyed the multiple whys in that way.
Thank
Good
you.
Job.
Guy next to me on the train definitely has Ebola. Remind me not to watch the boxing with a girl again. And a lot of girls need to learn the art of class. The context of some of these tweets is not immediately apparent, particularly that last one. But as I mean, as I said in the intro, there's also, there are apparently references to Madeleine McCann, who was kidnapped in, was it Portugal or years ago? The suicide of Gary Speed, a footballer Gary Speed, and also derogatory comments about women, Asian people, and people with disabilities.
And actually, he also used the hashtag racist.
Yes.
which is slight, which is, you know, quite unambiguous.
Oddly self-aware. What were your feelings kind of seeing these tweets? And
he was meant to be 18 when these were posted, right?
I think that's correct.
Yeah, I think people generally at 18 are idiots.
Yeah,
having been an 18-year-old boy, with Twitter, I think I had Twitter at 18. I'm actually planning on doing a background check on myself because I'm pretty sure I tweeted some really stupid stuff. Especially Twitter seems to be kind of like the biggest problem, right? I've definitely said problematic things. Like, I've not always had as nuanced a view of the world as I have now. Now, of course, I'm fully formed and mature and I know everything. Yeah, I mean, the stuff that he's tweeted is pretty unambiguously on the, oh, holy shit, this is quite bad side of things.
I think right? that some of them are the sort of, like, offensive comments that teenage boys...
Yeah, that you hear on the bus home from
yeah,
school.
Would make to
yeah,
each other.
Yeah, 100%.
And I suppose one of the things about social media...
It is, if you will, locker room talk.
Oh, great reference.
Thank you.
And so it's, I suppose, it's not entirely clear how... ironic he's being in some of these, or if he's being deliberately offensive for the sake of it and knows he's being offensive.
I know I did GCSE English, but I didn't really know what irony was when I was 18.
What are you saying?
I don't think that there was necessarily irony here. I think he's just doing like, oh, I'm doing a funny thing, you know?
Yeah, but what I mean is it's not clear he necessarily means the things he's saying, or if he's saying them for effect.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Ironic in that sense.
To be fair, hashtag racist included.
Yes, I would kind of say so.
I don't think actual racists often hashtag their tweets as hashtag racist.
You might be surprised.
Oh, really? Okay.
I don't know.
Maybe I need to know some more racists.
Maybe you do. We should broaden our guest list for this podcast.
If you... No, don't... I actually think one of the most problematic things I've ever done is have Sargon of Akkad on the podcast. I'm almost certain that one day that's going to come back and bite me on the ass.
I'm sure you'll be fine. You protested thoroughly throughout the entirety of the episode, and have done so since. So that was
as long as you got my back, Jimmy, and you're happy for me to throw you under the bus.
So for people not aware, Sargon of Akkad was a YouTube gobshite on the alt-right. He would say he wasn't on the alt-right, so he later ran for a UKIP MEP, I feel
they kind of accidentally his name's Carl
Benjamin
he accidentally deliberately, him and kind of like all of the UK alt-right people unexpectedly took over UKIP for like 6 months, didn't they?
They did,
and then
yeah.
they failed and then left.
It was an incredible act of entryism that wasn't even subtle. It should be
my
said.
My feedback anyway, Jimmy, is please no more racists on the pod, thank you.
I make no promises. So Ollie Robinson, to be fair to him, has issued a statement of contrition. I'm embarrassed.
What does that mean?
He's sorry. sorry, I forget you don't know words. So, quote, I'm embarrassed by the racist and sexist tweets that I posted over 8 years ago, which today have become public. Not entirely true, they were always public, but I know what he means. I want to make it clear that I'm not a racist and not a sexist. I deeply regret my actions and I'm ashamed of making such remarks. It was thoughtless and irresponsible, and regardless of my state of mind at the time, my actions were inexcusable. Since that period, I've matured as a person and fully regret the tweets. I mean, we all have sent tweets we regret, I think, as you've said, Jazza. I kind of don't think these tweets are that big a deal in a way. They are obviously stupid, but you know, teenagers say stupid shit all the time. It just so happens that this is written down in a publicly available record. I don't know if they've now been deleted, which they quite possibly have. But so do you think that would you support Boris Johnson's comment? This is from a spokesperson for Boris Johnson. The Prime Minister is supportive of Oliver Dowden's comments. He's referring to the Culture Secretary, I think, who said something along these lines. As Dowden set out, these were comments made more than a decade ago by someone as a teenager and for which they've rightly apologised. Is that fair?
Well, why did you have to frame this as, do you agree with Boris Johnson?
Because I thought it would make it more difficult for you to agree with the sentiment.
Well, you are correct in your assumption. I think all of the correct things have happened.
Mm.
It's correct that these things have... Is it correct that these things have come to light? These things are in the public realm.
Sure.
And therefore they should be... And he is a public person as a international sportsman, and so they should be scrutinized. It is right that there was uproar about it. It is right that he apologized, and I think it's right that there is some kind of repercussion. I don't know enough about cricket and the way that to play as a discipline, to be completely honest, to know if this is kind of like an appropriate response.
I think
all of the things that should have happened have happened, and he seems to have genuinely changed. The only maybe extra thing that I would suggest is like maybe he thinks about ways of being able to like maybe right some of the wrongs that he said, maybe volunteer some time at women's empower, I don't know.
You want him to do some penance, basically.
That would look good, wouldn't it?
I guess so. I mean, I just...
Because it is all... Like, he could feasibly brush it all off. But he hasn't. But if he really wants to, like, show that he is sorry... saying sorry is a lot harder than showing you're sorry. If he wants to show that he's sorry, then he could go that extra mile. But I don't think he... I don't think he necessarily needs to. I'm not sure he's necessarily asking for my input, Jimmy.
No, but I mean, we are doing a podcast segment on him, so you can give your input. I mean, in terms of the wider context for this, the England and Wales Cricket Board is apparently going to do a sort of fully fledged social media review on kind of historical, and to address any historical issues is the phrase they use, around cricketers' social media posts from way back when. I can understand why he's apologised, but I don't...
Oh, wouldn't you? I think that the apology is pretty, that's embarrassing to have that stuff come out, and you're definitely going to feel bad about it. Would you not apologise? This is why you don't play cricket for Sussex.
I don't think it's the main reason. I don't know. I don't think I've ever. Some people might disagree. I don't think I've ever posted anything that straightforwardly like bigoted on Twitter. Maybe you should go through my tweets, Jazza, which is a task I'm sure you're delighted doing. Or 12 years, I think it would be, of tweets, and you can decide whether there is anything offensive in there. But I sort of think it's like, well, I said some dumb stuff as a teenager. I've probably said stuff. I've probably made jokes that offensive in private and not 100%. Posted them on the internet. I've probably done it recently.
We both went to boys' school.
Yeah,
didn't we? Or like all boys' schools are full of this shit.
Yeah, they are.
Which doesn't mean it's okay, but it explains it.
I think it depends. It's not okay if like people express genuinely racist sentiments, but the problem is the sentiments, not really the fact that it's said. If people make offensive jokes for the sake of provocation or, you know, for effect or whatever, I think that's kind of legitimate in and of itself, really.
Mm-hmm. But also I think as a teenager, and especially teenage boys do this, they are, as they mature, quote unquote, when does a man mature? Who knows?
When his sex drive collapses completely.
Yeah, 100%. I think part of like the maturing process, especially for young men, is testing where the boundaries are.
Definitely.
And this is part of the testing of those boundaries. And part of the testing of those boundaries is sometimes being slapped down and told that you're a twat.
Yeah, but probably the right time for that was when he posted the tweets, not 10 years
hence. Yeah, but nobody, clearly nobody noticed, did they?
I think it probably would have been okay for them to remain unnoticed, because I just don't necessarily buy that reflective of him now, and apart from anything else.
Yeah, I think it would be different if it were in the private sphere. If these were private communications that he had had, maybe, as a teenager. But they are still in the public sphere.
I guess there's that interesting question, because WhatsApp wouldn't have been around at the time, but if he just sent these to, say, a group chat in WhatsApp, it would be a little bit different, I think.
Yeah, I think so too, but I don't know how I feel about that.
It's tricky though, because Twitter often feels like a private messaging platform in a way, doesn't it? I mean, it obviously has direct messages.
If you approach Twitter like that, then you're an idiot.
Yeah, I agree, but I think the way it's set up is quite conducive to
thinking. Makes it feel like it is.
Yeah,
same with Facebook and stuff, right?
Yeah. So the social media catastrophe rolls on, I think we can say. Jazza, should we talk about the G7?
I'd love to. So, pick your poison. Do you think we're going to leave the G7? Today is the last day. Are we going to leave the G7 having solved climate change?
No.
having solved the vaccine shortage in developing nations?
No.
Or will we have come out having actually reduced our likability in the world because of Boris Johnson being a bit of a twazzic?
It's possible. I saw online that his son, is it Wilfred, has apparently gone down very well. But he's sort of, I assume he's a cute child.
He's a 1-year-old.
Yeah, and he's have you seen the mop on his head?
I mean, they've really gone for the branding thing hard, haven't they?
I think so. I mean, at least they fully know that it's Boris Johnson's kid at this stage.
We won't go down that route.
Well, I mean, if. Yeah, let's leave that subject alone for 1 week. I don't really know, because I think one of the main sort of kerfuffles that have emerged between Britain and some of the other countries here. So the British ministers have been complaining that other, particularly EU ministers, have been treating Northern Ireland as if it was a separate country from the rest of the UK. And I mean, the story's...
and then Macron said... suggested, apparently reported in the Times, that that Northern Ireland wasn't part of the UK in the same way that, say, for example, Toulouse was part of France.
Yeah, so
why Toulouse? I don't know.
Yeah, Emmanuel Macron, president of France.
Le président de France.
Exactly. I mean, in a way, it obviously depends where you put the emphasis, but Northern Ireland is not as integral a part of the UK as, say, a mainland French department, in the sense that in terms of how it's governed, it is governed, there is actually a sort of, there's a recognition that Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, has legitimate interests in terms of how Northern Ireland is governed. And there is an element of like collaboration, understanding that. Obviously, we've also got the EU.
Are you saying that nuance wasn't being considered or reported on when the Times decided to publish this article?
Well, I think it's not entirely clear to me what exactly Macron said, so it depends how he said it to me, and
probably in a French accent,
probably, yeah, ooh la la, etc.
Northern Ireland is not part of the UK in the same way as Toulouse is part of La France. That's
brilliant. Yeah.
How offensive is that?
I don't know. But Dominic Raab has said it's offensive for Macron to imply Northern Ireland is not fully part of the UK. And this is a, where's this quote from? I put it up in The Guardian. So he says, we've serially seen senior EU figures, quite a tongue twister, talk about Northern Ireland as if it was some kind of different country to the UK. This is not only offensive, it has real world effects in the communities in Northern Ireland, etc. He said, can you imagine if we talked about Catalonia, the Flemish part of Belgium, one of the land in Germany, Northern Italy, Corsica and France as different countries? The weird thing is, I feel like all of those examples, to some degree, do sort of reflect the fact that there are, you know, some of these places are slightly at odds with their the country they're fully part of in a
also,
like, political
can
sense.
Can I just say, that is... I find that so hypocritical for a representative of this government to be talking about the way that others are treating Northern Ireland so flippantly. They have been treating Northern Ireland so flippantly. They're the reason that they can't get Percy Pigs and fucking Marks and Spencers in them. They're the reason that they agreed that they were going to have some kind of checks and that there was going to be a border in the Irish Sea. Hmm. That's their work. And it makes me, can you feel it? I feel really actually quite angry about that shifting of the goalposts and trying to say that, oh, this is the EU undermining the Good Friday Agreement. It's them. They did that.
So you're referring to the fact that under the Brexit deal, Northern Ireland is still part of the single market. And as you say, I'm right in saying that, right? It's still part of the single market.
Yes.
And there is a customs border down the Irish Sea, as you put it. So,
and the UK at the moment is choosing to ignore the necessity, as per the agreement, for there to be custom checks of goods going between mainland Britain and Northern Ireland.
Yeah. I feel it also, even pre this current government, I do feel that Northern Ireland is it was politically quite neglected in mainstream political discourse. Yeah. I mean, it was mentioned in the Brexit debate. I think it would be unfair to say that it wasn't touched on at all.
Minimally.
Yeah.
We talked about it, I think, quite more than the fucking BBC did. But that's because we're the type of people who think about that.
Yeah, I guess so. And I just feel like the way Northern Ireland is dealt with sometimes, you sort of get the impression that London considers it to be quite an inconvenient part of the United Kingdom, which would not...
Well, it is.
It is inconvenient, politically speaking.
But almost by design, because, the independence of Ireland was a messy was a mess.
Still is, in a way. considering the fallout from everything. Mm-hmm. It is... I sort of find those comments by... Macron, obviously it depends how he said it, but maybe some other people, they're not entirely wrong, are they? You can say they're offensive, and I'm sure there are people in Northern Ireland, such as the DUP, that would find them very offensive, but that doesn't mean they're untrue. So going beyond this particular fracas, did you hear this thing that Gordon Brown, former Labour Prime Minister, said about the G7's vaccine plan for the developing world?
No, do tell me.
So he said that it was not ambitious enough. Quote, when we needed 11 billion vaccines, we've only got offered a plan for 1 billion. I think this summit will also go down as an unforgivable moral failure. When the richest countries are sitting at the table with the power to do something about it. And, you know, Gordon Brown has a very deep Scottish accent. It is the sound of authority, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, he was always quite good in the post-crash days at these conferences. He was quite well respected by a lot of world leaders because he is really fucking smart and gets shit done.
Yeah,
honestly, I think he's an incredibly capable politician and diplomat and individual in that way, to be honest. Didn't like him at the time, but you know what, hindsight.
Nobody liked prime ministers at the time. It's an honor.
Yeah. Realistically, I mean, I don't know what goes on at these things, but it feels like they've been having a lovely time. It's been a great advert for holidaying on the north of Cornwall.
skipped past the vaccine discussion and get back to what people really care about, which is their summer holidays.
Yeah, I mean, the English Riviera absolutely bloody beautiful. I think, well, it depends on what kind of like gets announced at the end of today, really, because this is the end of the summit. But if all of that stuff is true, then I mean, yeah, it is, and it is bad broadly. But how much of that is that Boris Johnson's fault? Are we being too UK centric when if we ask that question?
Most Western countries are being a bit selfish about their vaccines, so I don't think the UK is alone in that. Obviously, the Oxford one, is that the AstraZeneca one?
Correct.
Yeah, that was developed here, so I suppose we probably have more leverage in that situation to spread it around
but
the world.
But there are big worries, are there not, about vaccine diplomacy becoming a big thing that the West just chooses not to partake in because Russia is donating a butt ton of the Sputnik vaccine, and the Sinopec vaccine from China is also being given to developing nations, whereas we seem to not be doing really very much of that at all. I mean, we ignore the developing nations that need these vaccines at our peril because they'll remember that.
So this is something that Gordon Brown was actually saying, is that there's kind of a self-interested motive in giving vaccines to poorer nations, and that the more vaccinated they are, the less chance there is of new variants emerging and then spreading back to, you know, the richer countries. So I think, you know, aside from being an unforgivable moral failure, in Brown's words, it also just makes good sense, I think, to make sure people are as vaccinated as possible.
Then why do you think there is so much attrition to them doing this? Like, they seem to be saying all of the correct things, that they intend to give stuff back. Why doesn't that seem to be happening?
Well, I think there's some appetite to vaccinate younger people in Western countries because it tends to be older people that have been vaccinated so far. So I think there's sort of a straightforward zero-sum game in some ways between vaccinating, you know, young people in the UK versus, you know, other people in a country like, say, India. But does some of it have, you know, I wonder if some of it has something to do with like pharmaceutical IP, intellectual property law, and that kind of thing. And, you know, a lot of these things were developed by private companies ultimately. And I suppose maybe there's implications beyond just what, people getting these vaccines. So, but I don't really know. is the short answer. I can only speculate. But it's not a good look. And I think you're right. The diplomatic consequences. I mean, you know, if you sort of talk in broader foreign policy terms, there's a lot of analysts warning that, say, China is supplying military equipment to South America. This is a similar argument, really. If you're supplying like medical innovation in the form of vaccines, you know, you're competing with countries like China and Russia that are doing similar things. And I mean, that sort of stuff is remembered. And just in the basic sense of, you know, if you're a poorer country, you can become reliant on the expertise, be it military or medical or whatever else, of a superpower like China. And that's not in the long-term Western interest, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. I agree. On climate change, which is kind of like the one thing that we haven't really touched on, apart from the taxation stuff, but I think that like we'll have other opportunities to cover that, I think.
Yeah.
Are we fucked?
On climate change?
Yes.
In general. I'm not a scientist, Jazza, and I'm almost happy to leave it there, but... I was actually one of the things that we were talking about how lush the St. Ives coastline looks, but there was also some pretty visually pleasing protests from the likes of Extinction Rebellion, just people dressing up in pretty impressive costumes, and a bunch of people have also gone on paddle boats into just off the beach of Falmouth, which is near to St. Ives. So it's been a good time for like protests, I think.
Sunny, paddle boards, beautiful. There has been, I don't, because my computer has crashed, which is why I sound funny now. there were commitments to, was it half? I don't have the stats up, to like half emissions by 2030 or something along those lines. What were the commitments? There were commitments yesterday.
Oh, I mean, you should have forewarned me, and I would have brought these up.
Is now me warning you.
I think as a general point, I think that there's a kind of, you know, environmentalist protester that just essentially just never thinks that any of these commitments are enough. And I think that most politicians are trying to balance economic needs, which feed into things like treatments, like treatments for coronavirus and the vaccines and that sort of thing. So it's not that this is just about providing bread and circuses for everybody and ensuring everybody has a big flat screen TV. You know, these things are very fundamental to people's quality of lives. So they're trying to balance those economic concerns. Whereas if you're an environmental protester, kind of the only thing, like the main thing you care about is the environment. And I just think the emphasis is in a different place. I mean, they would argue if they were here that, you can't really, if the planet's on fire, then it doesn't matter what medical equipment you have. But I don't know, really. I feel like whenever these agreements are signed, there are always people who think that they don't go far enough. And I think that's kind of the nature of the game. But they might be right. As I said earlier, I'm not a scientist. So.
Yeah. I don't know. There's been a lot of talk about the hypocrisy of the G7 leaders flying in private planes down to Newquay Airport in order to attend this, when even the Queen took the fucking train. And also the fact that Boris Johnson is still considering opening like a new coal power plant, which of course is very good for the place where they will open it in terms of jobs, but not very good for the wider environment. Keep it in the ground, I think, is the general consensus for most experts. And it's very difficult for them to sound self-righteous and make all the noises when what they're doing is a bit hypocritical.
I think there is the school of thought among environmentalists appears to be very much based on the cease these kind of activities idea. And whereas there are other people who argue that the route to progress is actually through technological innovation. So, you know, instead of, it's the sort of thing that says, okay, we can't stop burning fossil fuels today because, our lives depend on them in so many ways. But what
because
we can,
lobbyists are very powerful.
Well, you could also argue that. And, you know, financial interest is 100% part of this. I'm not saying it isn't, but they, you know, there are people who say actually what we need to do is develop new forms of renewable energy and go sort of forward that way. So not stop immediately, but gradually progress out of things. And, you know, some people will say, well, by the time you actually get to that stage, we'll all be fucked. So it's a terrible idea. This is something I'm, again, to repeat myself, I'm utterly unqualified to talk about, Jazza. So,
excellent. Stop
asking me questions.
Okay, sure. On that beautiful note, shall we wrap this up?
We can do indeed. Jazza, where can they find you on the internet?
I am at Jazza John on all social media platforms because I'm what, Jimmy?
You're a good internet boy.
I'm a good internet boy.
I'm not such a good internet boy, so the best place to find me is on Twitter at JDE Nichols, where I will not be posting horrendously offensive Ollie Robinson style tweets.
Good boy. Well done. What an improvement.
Yeah,
excellent. Okay, bye everybody.
Bye bye.
Try not to die of the heat.